Hi, gang. Welcome to Tube Talk.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople.
Been a long time gone, old Constantinople, still is Turkish delight on a moonlight night.
Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, not Constantinople.
So if you were dating Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul.
Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say. People just liked it better that way.
Take me back to Constantinople.
Oh, no, you can't go back to Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople.
Why did Constantinople get the word?
That's nobody's business but the Turks. Constantinople, been a long time gone, old Constantinople.
Still it's Turkish delight on a moonlight night.
Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, not Constantinople.
So if you were dating Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul.
Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say.
People just liked it better that way.
Now won't you take me back to Constantinople?
No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople.
Now why did Constantinople get the work?
That's nobody's business but the Turks.
Since you went away, how I think about you all through the day, my buddy, nobody quite so true. I miss your voice and the touch of your hand. I long to know that you understand, my buddy, your buddy misses.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have tuned in to radio at its finest. This is Tube Talk, the zenith of the independently produced fine radio experience. Thanks so much for joining us this evening. And our first song, a little Istanbul, that's Bing and Ella. Goes out for Code Fox, by request, one of our loyal listeners. And let's see, that was, I believe it was, and it is, that was Ziggy Elman on the horn. So kicking off with that, and a little My Buddy. That's Frank Sinatra and Harry James, 1939. They had a very interesting six-month relationship. And, you know, kiddies, if you want to gather around the radio, Uncle Paul will tell you a little story about Harry James and how he found Frank Sinatra. This is from some, I got an article here I found by a gentleman, George T. Simon, apparently was a writer, and commented on the music scene and such. And let's see. So here's Harry James, exhausted after a full day of appearances leading his new band in New York's Paramount Theater. Goes back to his hotel room, turns on the radio. Oh, yes. And it happened to be tuned to New York's WNEW radio station, which happened to be broadcasting the music of Harold Arden's band from the Rustic Cabin across the Hudson in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, where a boy singer whose name had been announced before Harry had turned on the radio, but not repeated when he completed the song, had knocked Harry James for a loop. "I'd never heard anything like him," Harry recalled some years later. "So the next night, after our last show, I went over to the Rustic Cabin. I asked the manager, where could I find the boy singer? Manager says, we don't have a boy singer." "But we do have an MC, and he sings a little bit." Well, the MC, of course, was Frank Sinatra, and the rest is etched in vinyl, or shall we say, probably shellac, in 1939.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend my lonely nights dreaming of a song. The melody haunts my heart, and I am once again with you when our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration. It's in the stardust of a song beside the garden wall. When stars were bright, you were in my arms. The nightingale always told the fairy tale of paradise where roses grew. Though I dream in vain, in my heart it will remain. My stardust melody, the memory of love's refrain. Thank you. I didn't care. More than words can say. If I didn't care, would I feel this way? If this isn't love, then maybe I'm wrong. But why do I lie awake all night and dream all day long? If I didn't care, would it be the same? Would my every prayer begin and end with just your name? And could I be sure that this is love beyond compare? Would all this be true if I didn't care for you?
Couple of real beauts, Harry James and Frank Sinatra, the boy singer. Both of those from the Roseland Ballroom, July of 1939, a very early Sinatra. And I guess he was quite a student of singing and music, and you know, he put some thought into it. Interesting that we remember him for some of the, or at least contemporary America remembers him for some of the bigger, brassier, more brash Sinatra, the Vegas Sinatra, New York, New York, and I Did It My Way. And not to take anything away from all that stuff, but a very interesting man early in his career. And as the story goes, when he auditioned for Harry James, the Lincoln Hotel, you know, Sinatra comes in, there's other guys going to do their audition. They've got charts and notes and all kinds of stuff, and Frank just walked in and went over to the piano player and told him what he wanted to sing, what key he wanted to sing in, stood up and sang, and knocked everybody out. And needless to say, he got the job for 6 months. What a combination, the voice and the horn. Now, am I still coming through? You hearing me pretty good?
Yeah, you're dropped in volume a little, but I can crank you up here.
Tell you what, I'll,
yeah, that's better. Right,
I'll get my level up, and I'll get a little closer to the mic. And your level is pretty good there, too. So I think okay. We're just about ready here to run. So we'll give a little intro here, and we'll get going here. So,
all right.
In our radio pilot tonight, Tube Talk is very pleased to welcome Mike Simpson. He joins us from the Midwest Radio Museum, which is a museum of his own creation. And guess what? It focuses on Midwest radios. Mike, thanks a lot for being on tonight. We appreciate it.
Sure, I'm glad to talk to you, Paul.
You know, the Midwest Radio Company is really kind of a fascinating little segment of the radio world. And I guess, you know, they're right in the Midwest. They're from Cincinnati. And, you know, so before we get over to Midwest and talk about some of their sets and some of their style, because they certainly had style, just to ask you, as we ask a lot of our guests here, how did you get interested first time around in antique radio to begin with?
Well, ever since I was a little kid, it seems like I've had an interest in old radios. My grandfather used to own a radio repair shop in Sales, and a lot of my early knowledge was gained from him. But as my mom said, I used to take apart lamps before I could walk. Can't say as I put them back together, but it just went from there. To what it is today, I guess.
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. I have a few friends, we take apart radios, and we never quite get them back together.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're easier. So, you know, so much, you know, for the lamps, you're not alone there. Now, you've got this nifty online museum, and it exists in real life, I'm imagining, in your home. It takes up a pretty good chunk of space there. As the proprietor, I have to ask you, how did you fall in love with Midwest? Because it certainly seems like that's your focus. And how'd you wind up picking them?
Well, when I was maybe about 15 or so, I wandered into a radio store, a radio TV sales store in Kalamazoo, which was my hometown. In the back, they had kind of an annex department, which where they sold their used trade-ins.
I see.
And back in a corner, I saw this quite large, looming-looking console radio, and, geez, I just loved the looks of it. It turned out to be a Midwest from 1937, and I guess that kind of started it. I ended up getting the radio. Later on, of course, through the years, it got disposed of through my moving and so forth. But here in California, I happened on another one, and that was probably in the very early 70s. And I just kind of thought, you know, gee, nobody likes these things, but I do, and I think I'll just start seeing if I can collect a few. And that collection's gone on now for, I guess, close to 40 years and to what I have today, which I think is probably close to 200 of the things.
Well, that's great, you know, and it's great that you'd stick with it, too, because, you know, it's interesting. You find a lot of collectors who, you know, they'll go through phases. You know, some guys will go through a big Zenith phase, and then they'll say, well, you know, I've collected so many, and well, I'm going to start thinning those out, and I'm going to focus on Philco, or I'm going to focus on this. So it's nice to see somebody who's dedicated to a particular set all the way from Kalamazoo, too, so... it's a great musical city there, immortalized in music. Now,
right.
Midwest had sort of this, a very sharp, sort of a highly stylized deco look. And when I've seen either articles in different magazines, or I'm lucky enough to see one at a show, or I'll see photographs from other clubs' shows. You know, in your opinion, I mean, were they right up there? I mean, they certainly seem to be the one of the, you know, more highly stylized sets of their era.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you on that. I don't know if you really call them a leader or not, because there are other, I can think of Majestic.
Yep.
Also had a few pretty sharp sets of that era. But, Midwest, I agree. You talk about deco style, and that was true deco, where I think most cabinets of the 30s and so forth were just at what I'd call period pieces more than deco.
Yeah, and I would agree with you on that. And it's also interesting, too. They had sort of an interesting business model there, buy factory direct. So these were radios that you weren't going to find if you went to, you know, your radio shop, furniture store, other outlets that would sell radio in those days. And so this was something where they felt they were giving the consumer a definite price break and, giving them a superior radio. And they, you know, along with that comes some very interesting advertising, because as I was looking through your site, you know, you have a lot of the, some of the look like either magazine ads or different ads that they would run in print. And, you know, so I was familiar with Sears having Silvertones, and Silvertones were sold through the Sears catalog, obviously. And, you know, part of the whole idea was, well, this is, you know, direct from Sears to you, and we cut out the middleman. Now Midwest sold direct, and so this was something that somebody would actually wind up getting shipped to them. They weren't available in showrooms, right?
That's correct, yeah. Midwest did have, I understand, a showroom in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, I think everything was mail-ordered and ship direct. In the later years, I understand they did have a West Coast showroom here in Los Angeles. I don't know what year that was, however, but I assume it was kind of in the late or early 40s or maybe right after the war.
Now, they were headquartered right in Cincinnati, from what I understand, correct?
That's correct. Uh-huh.
So thus the name Midwest Radio Company. And, you know, just some of these ads are just, I really can't get to say enough about them. make extra money as a Midwest user agent. So, I mean, it almost sounded, from what I was reading in this particular ad, that, you know, if you're a happy customer, they'd encourage you to go out and tell your friends or bring them over and show them your set and show them what kind of performance you could get out of it and convince them that, you know, you too should be a Midwest owner, which was kind of an interesting thing, you know, for its day, because, I mean, you hear, you know, people do things like that now with various products, and you know, these guys were doing that in the 30s. That sounds kind of unique.
Yeah, that's right. And then Midwest would offer you a little, you know, cash incentive if you would sell a set, if they get a referral, you know, from you. So.
Well, that was, you know, so I mean, you know, as they always said in these ads, you know, when they were trying to get people into, whether it was radio repair or, you know, whether in this case they called it the user agent, turn your spare cash, you know, spare time into extra cash, you know, as if people had a lot of spare time, you know, fighting the Depression at all, but,
yeah,
you know, they were out to do it. So, and they eventually went into TV and some other products. When did Midwest kind of fizzle out as a company? Was it in the late 50s, I guess?
Yeah, it appears that about 1955 was about their last real products. The company did exist on to, I guess, 56 or 57, but their catalogs were more like a small J.C. Penney catalog.
I see.
They offered all kinds of appliances and jewelry, just a little bit of everything, but all, again, at a special factory reduced price, you know, when mailed to you. So.
Yeah, you know, the catalog business was is kind of, I mean, even as a kid, you know, myself, I can remember Heathkit did the catalog. I certainly can remember the Sears catalog, which had everything under the sun. But, you know, now, I mean, I guess you'd say, well, it's all replaced by the internet. But, you know, the design and the engineering, and again, this was Midwest Radio Laboratories, they had some pretty good stuff. Do you have in your collection a couple of sets that you would say are your favorite performers, or anything in particular you would call our attention to if somebody wanted to Google one of these Midwests up and take a look at one? Any of your favorites we should know about?
Well, they do. There were a couple special models that they made that you don't see very often. Of course, you don't see Midwest very often. But in 35, they did offer what they called the Midwest Imperial, which was a special limited edition 18-tube set in a special oversized, even bigger cabinet. They're quite unique and very rare. And then in 36, they offered the Royale series, which was a 24-tube radio.
Wow.
Dual chassis with three speakers. Very advanced, high-fidelity set for the time. So those are probably the most rare of the Midwest, I'd say.
And they sound like they would be strong performers, too, from your descriptions of them, probably with a nice big speaker. And, you know, they had some sharp-looking dials as well. And, you know, it's hard to say what draws people to a set, but, you know, did Midwest market their stuff all over the country, or were they primarily focused in the heartland? Or, I mean, like I said, we were talking a little bit earlier before the show. I don't see a heck of a lot of it up here, and that might not really be very accurate for me to say that they didn't sell up here just because I don't see it, because obviously they haven't been selling things for many, many years, and, you know, collectors hand radios back and forth and all that. But was there one area more than others? I mean, you're out in California now. Do they tend to turn up out there at all, or was it something you'd be more likely to find if you were in, you know, the Ohio, Illinois, Michigan area? Where do you find these things?
Yeah, well, it would seem that you'd see more of them in the Midwest, and I think that's kind of common for a lot of radios. They certainly do have a presence out here. I found quite a few of them here on the West Coast over the years. As well, they did sell nationally. They also sold worldwide.
Interesting.
They had a facility in out in London that I'm aware of. I've gotten correspondence from people in Spain and South America, Australia, even in Russia, that have found a Midwest over in their own country. And they were, in some cases, even made for the European market. The cabinet styles were different. Of course, some areas were 220 volts.
Sure.
So yeah, they had a pretty good presence all around, I'd say.
And it's fascinating that some guy in Moscow would find one and, you know, contact you to tell you about it, and I can't seem to find one in greater Boston. But that sort of the story of my collecting life is, you know, I'm one step behind everybody. But, you know, with this website, it must be interesting. I mean, you're there, so anybody who's searching for something that's Midwest has got a good shot of coming across you. So you must hear from a lot of different people with some interesting stories about their Midwest stuff. Do you get a lot of correspondence through the website?
Yeah, I get a fair amount. It kind of comes and goes. Sometimes I won't hear anything from anybody for months at a time, and then all of a sudden you get three or four inquiries a week, you know. But yeah, I do get them from all over the world, it seems.
That's great. Now, I'm taking it as a lot of collectors do. I mean, some collect and don't restore or don't really actively listen to too many of their sets. Do you still actively use these sets you have in your collection?
Yeah, there's a few that I play, I'd say more than others. Not all of my sets are at the moment in working condition, to tell you the truth. I do my own electronics and cabinet work, but to tell you the truth, I'm always working on somebody else's stuff other than my own.
Well, that's a common theme. You know, I know people who say, you know what, if I could just stop working on all these others for my pals and people will pay me something for it, maybe I can get to my own stuff. Yeah. Now, I was just curious, you know, because you're out on the West Coast there, and anything that you might be listening to, I mean, do you ever pick up, what's the DX like out there? Do you ever have some good luck picking up a distant station with the Midwest?
I don't really go DX in very much anymore.
I see.
The area that I'm in is we have relatively high amount of line noise, which kind of limits me quite a bit, but in my early days, I can remember my first Midwest listening to that and listening to a lot of foreign broadcasts. And used to spend a lot of hours in front of that set.
You know, it fascinated me. I recently interviewed this woman a couple of weeks back on the show. Her name is Lisa Spar, and she lives in Missouri now, and she has written a book. And I don't have it in front of me, so I'm going to try to remember the title as best I can. Letters of Compassion, World War II Letters of Compassion, I believe, is the title. And in the book, she focuses on, you know, citizens who were listening to shortwave broadcasts, getting information on the whereabouts or the status of POWs in either Japan or in Germany. And, you know, so we had a great talk, and, you know, it's funny because there's sort of the usage side of the equation with just the activities of these people, but then there's the radio side of it, and a fellow up here, his name is Jerry Berg, wrote a review, and I guess he's active in, likes to collect QSLs and active in the amateur community up here, and he found an advertisement, and it was for a Midwest radio, believe it or not, and you know, they were talking about, in particular, the stellar shortwave performance of it. And strangely enough, the person in the ad who was sitting on a seat listening to this Midwest, and I don't know the model number, and I can't recall the guy's name, sadly, he found this advertisement. And so here's a guy who's documented in the book as being one of these folks who was writing letters to tell people that their loved ones were okay. And he himself had that nice Midwest, and here he is sitting there. In Midwest, you know, used it as an advertisement. So it really just came together very nicely. And I guess even then, you know, they had a great reputation for being very hot on the shortwave bands. And you were saying that some of the sound on some of the higher tube count sets, I'm taking it with bigger speakers and consoles, they had a pretty good sound as well.
Oh, sure, yeah. And they weren't overly, more true to life than some other manufacturers that tended to extend the bass maybe too much, for instance.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, they were always pleasing to my ear anyway. And for most people, I've even run comparisons of, a Tombstone by Brand X and a Midwest table model. And I said, here, listen to these, listen to this one, then listen to this Midwest. Which one do you like best? And Most of the time people will say the Midwest, but maybe they're just being kind to me.
Well, if they know, right, because you might not let them go until they pick the Midwest.
There you go.
It's like the blind taste test they used to do for the sodas. Now, if we were going to take you out and strand you somewhere out in the Pacific on a desert island, out of all those Midwest sitting at your house, which one would you have to take with you?
I'd probably take the 1937 Model X, which was the first one that I had owned when I was a teenager, mainly just because of the sentimental value.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, sets come and go, and people get into more sophisticated electronics, but, you know, oftentimes there's still a soft spot, you know, for that first set. And I still have my old, you know, one of my first tube sets that I took when I was probably about 13, 14 years old. And even though it's an old Silvertone, but even though it's not the fanciest or the best performing, still kind of has a soft spot there. Now, for anybody who wants to check out some of this nifty stuff, it's a very simple web address. It's MidwestRadioMuseum.com, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, that's correct.
So, you know, I'd encourage you all out there, take a look at what Mike has collected and restored. If you're looking for something that really sort of is the epitome of that Art Deco period, check it out. And next time, you know, you're at the Swamp Meets, keep your eyes open. You might just find a nice Midwest that was shipped FOB Cincinnati. And, Mike, it's great that you can keep them in good shape out there and have a nice little testimony to them right there in your museum. Thanks so much for being on. We appreciate it. Have a great night.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate you the call.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Whenever I feel afraid, I hold my head erect and whistle a happy tune so no one will suspect I'm afraid. While shivering in my shoes, I strike a careless pose and whistle a happy tune, and no one ever knows I'm afraid. The result of this deception is very strange to tell. For when I fool the people I fear, I fool myself as well. I whistle a happy tune, and every single time, the happiness in the tune convinces me that I'm not afraid. Make believe you're brave, and the trick will take you far. You may be as brave as you make believe you are. You may be as brave as you make believe you are. Believe you're brave, and the trick will take you far. You may be as brave as you make believe you are. You may be as brave as you make believe.
That's from The King and I, Mr. Sinatra, 1951, Axel Stordahl conducting the orchestra. Whistle a happy tune. You know, well, if you're listening to Tube Talk, you probably are listening to a happy tune. And we'd like to thank Mr. Mike Simpson from the Midwest Radio Museum for being on. Check out some of the swell-looking radios at MidwestRadioMuseum.com. And remember, act now. Order your radio direct from the Midwest factory today and save up to 80%, as thousands have been doing since 1920. Fill in that 30-day trial order coupon and mail it today. It's a little Harry James from 1943 without Frank Sinatra, boy singer. 2 o'clock jump.
Bloom on the hillside. you try, you'll find me where the sky meets the sea. Here am I, your special island. Come to me, come to me. Someday you'll see me floating in the sunshine, my head sticking out from a low-flying cloud. You'll hear me call you, singing through the sunshine, sweet and clear as can be. Bali high, you will whisper, here am I, come to me.
And that's a lovely song from South Pacific, 1949, Frank Sinatra's version of Bali High. Well, you know, thanks for tuning in tonight to hear Mike Simpson tell us about Midwest Radios. Thanks for joining us for our sort of Harry James, Frank Sinatra salute, I guess you'd call it. Maybe next time around, we'll bring in some Frank Sinatra with Tommy Dorsey and see what happened after he took off. He only lasted about 6 months with Harry. Nice guy that he was, let him out of his contract to go do the Tommy Dorsey things. I guess Dorsey had a falling out with his male singer. Anyway, James and Sinatra both went on for wonderful careers, and it's all to our benefit. Just to remind you, this is Tube Talk on WRCA 1330 AM. From acquisition to complete restoration, from rewiring to alignment, Tube Talk is the story of real radio repairmen in action. Wouldn't that make Jack Webb really happy? Maybe.
A break never happened. It's a chance that you pay, and say you do, say it and make my craziest dream come true.
Just a little more Harry James there. I had the craziest dream. I woke up and I was on a radio show. Imagine that. Well, it's almost time for us to turn that knob and hear the authoritative click of the vintage radio as we shut down for the night here. Tell all your pals to listen to Tube Talk on WRCA 1330 AM over the air, or visit the 1330 WRCA website. Listen to us on the streamer. Email the show. It's tubetalk1@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, gang. Good night.
Opportunity. fancy may come to me, it's true, but what care I, say I'll get by, as long as I have you.
Together.